All right. I think there's still some folks trickling in, but let's get started here. Just a quick housekeeping note. I think this chat's going to be about an hour and 15 minutes. After that, there will be food and drinks or some snacks out just through that back door. There. That's an incentive to stay for the entire thing. Anyway, welcome to Google. My name's Aaron Brindle. I head up communications for Google Canada, and as a former journalist, as the head of communications for Google, and as a member of the CGAF board, I'm thrilled to see Google hosting tonight's JTalk, going local or going niche, new news opportunities. Thank you to our sponsors tonight, BMO, in-kind sponsor Cision, and I invite guests here and on the live stream to tweet questions and comments at our hashtag CJFTalk. Now, the topic of tonight's conversation goes to the heart of an issue that's roiling the news industry, namely the economic sustainability of journalism in the digital age and the evolving business model of news. I suspect there are some folks in this room who find it ironic that Google is hosting tonight's talk. I think the internet is often blamed for much of the disruption that's happening in the news business. But on that, let me start by sharing like a very brief story. Just under a year ago, last November, the Globe and Mail sent a journalist to Orillia to cover a gathering of a few journalists there who were gathered for what they described as a wake of the Orillia Packet and Times. This was not just any paper that was going under. It wasn't just your typical local newspaper that was shuttering. This was a paper that had served a small town for 146 years, almost as long as Canada had been a country. And it had been immortalized by Stephen Leacock in Sunshine Sketches of a Small Town, where it's kind of described as kind of quirky tissue that connects a community community was called Mariposa, which was a thinly kind of veiled fictionalization of Orillia. So the shuttering, this is a big moment, and the Globe and Mail wrote about what it means to lose a source of local news and what that paper meant to a town. And it closes. The Globe and Mail wins an award for its story about its closing. And then over the next 6 weeks, Orillia has no news. It went untold. There was a fire that nearly razed a sporting complex. The semi-pro hockey team won some games. It wasn't reported. Developments at City Hall were not reported. Without an obituary section, people were complaining about missing funerals. Then in January, Village Media's Jeff Elgey, Jeff is here tonight, announced the launch of Orillia Matters. It's a news site for the people of Orillia. He hired a publisher, a regional editor, a reporter, a handful of freelancers. Basically, it was the same editorial team that had been at The Packet. Now, at its peak, The Packet had generated about 650,000 page views a month, and within 8 months of its first story going live in January, Orillia Matters is averaging over 1 million views today. The site has over 7,000 email subscribers, and people want local news. 98% of the stories that people read on Orillia Matters are local stories. Now, I know this because Jeff has been really transparent about Village Media's business. He's going to talk about it tonight. And he's replicated the same kind of success that he's had with Orillia Matters in other markets. But bringing this back to the question of the internet's relationship to news, and without scooping Jeff any further, I think it's important to think about the relationship between the local market and news. And it's clear that when you look at how, you know, the success that Jeff has had, it's not despite of the internet, but rather his success is underpinned by the power of the open web. Now, the World Wide Web is comprised of over 1.7 billion websites. It's an explosion of expression beyond anything we've ever seen or could fully imagine. The internet exponentially expanded both the marketplace for information and the marketplace for ideas. It has brought extraordinary value to our societies. It has introduced new challenges to our institutions, to our politics, and of course to journalism itself. And at the same time, we've seen revenue from classified ads, sales ads, job listings. They're no longer what they once were. And it was revenue that once supported serious journalism. You know, hard news in general interest newspapers was never the major draw for advertisers. So that does not mean that providing quality journalism cannot be a successful business. Rather, the models allowing journalism to flourish will have to be different. We're going to hear from David Scott from The Logic, an online journal taking a hard investigative approach to covering Canada's innovation economy. The Logic is circumventing the advertising business model altogether. Its model is mostly subscriber-based. So I'm not here to suggest that disruption that's happening in news is not a reality or that the pace of change shouldn't make many people in the business of news feel uncomfortable. But I think we need to get used to that feeling of discomfort. The challenges facing traditional news organizations are important to address because the profession of journalism matters. News it provides matters. And just to be clear, also to that earlier point, Google is not the internet. Rather, we do our best to connect news consumers to news publishers who have businesses on the open web, whether that's through Google News, Google Search, Google Play, YouTube. So when it comes to supporting business models for journalism, Google is stepping up its efforts. Earlier this year, we announced the Google News Initiative, Google's effort to help the news industry thrive in this digital age. And at the risk of sounding like a digital ad insertion myself, I'm just going to take a second just to touch on a few things in this space, and I'll move right on. On the distribution side, we're helping publishers reach and engage users wherever they are through products like AMP, which is to make their mobile pages faster. On the monetization side, we're helping publishers grow and diversify revenue streams, not only through ads that monetize their news inventory, but also through subscriber products. On the data side, we're doing really interesting things with machine learning. Vice is using machine translation to expand its reach into markets where they don't have reporters and they don't have the language capabilities. Washington Post is using it to develop monetization strategies. Training and education, we have News Lab, which is training newsrooms on our digital tools and digital products. We've introduced, or we're funding NewsWise, which is a CJAF and civics program to bring news literacy to Canadian schools. And we're funding. We've got a $300 million fund aimed at supporting innovation in news. And on that, actually, there's a small hook here that we recently announced as part of that fund, a $25 million program to increase video capabilities for publishers. The application date closes October 12th on that, so be aware. Now, the work being done at Google, at Village Media, at The Logic, and many, many others, leaves me optimistic about the future of news. There are so many tools and capabilities journalists can work with. There's so much impressive digital work being done. You know, Richard Gingras, who's the vice president of Google News, talks about today, these days, being a renaissance in journalistic and media creativity. New news experiences must be created, new business models must be developed, new media types defined, all necessary to assure our citizens have the tools they need to be good citizens. And clearly the health of our societies depend on it. So that's my preamble. It's a little long, I apologize. But let's get started. So I'm gonna introduce the moderator for tonight's chat. Sonia Fatah is the editor-in-chief of JSource and an assistant professor at the Ryerson School of Journalism. She has 15 years of international reporting experience. Her work has appeared in Maclean's, The Globe and Mail, Toronto Star, Walrus, Columbia Journalism Review. The list is actually longer, but
okay.
It's fine. I should point out here that Sonia's research interests also include nationalist discourse and its influence on foreign and local coverage and the impact of youth journalism projects in vulnerable communities. So, Sonia, welcome. I'll let you take it from here. Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you, Aaron, for the introduction. Did Jeff pay you some dollars for that spiel?
Yeah.
So, welcome, everyone. I'm here in my capacity as EIC of JSource, but also because two of the courses I teach at the Ryerson School of Journalism deal with publications. We bring out two of our signature publications of the Ryersonian and the Ryerson Review of Journalism. And so we're constantly thinking, even at the school, about how we should evolve those publications and move with the times. So I'm particularly interested in this issue. But this is also a subject that I'm assuming many of you are really familiar with, have raged about, discussed, had lots of fights with each other on. And I think the focus here today really should be on what the future is and not, I mean, the past bears in the future, but it really is, let's look at the models and how we can engage with new models as we move into this age. So I'm going to start with quickly introducing our three panelists. There is no order, there's no prop, there's no rhyme or reason, there's no logic to my introductions. But I will start with April, because April is a colleague of mine at the Ryerson School of Journalism. She is the Velma Rogers Research Chair, and she's also the principal investigator for the Local Research News Research Project. Her work explores local news poverty, a term she uses, and perhaps you can elaborate on that, to describe situations where the critical information needs of communities are not being addressed by local media. David Skok. So I've taken this bio right off his website, but I can tell you that I know that he likes taking long walks on the beach. Before founding The Logic, do we have subscribers in the audience?
We need more.
Great.
There you go.
Okay, so at least six subscribers. He was previously the associate editor and head of editorial strategy at the Toronto Star, and has served at the Boston Globe as managing editor and vice president of digital, where he led the organization's digital transformation, and was also the co-creator and director of digital for Global News. So he's had a lot of experience in different markets and different places. He is a leading thinker on digital transformation and co-published with Harvard Business School professor Clayton M. Christensen a paper for with the Nieman Lab, right? What was under the...
Neiman reports.
Right. And we'll come back to that thesis, the thesis of that report, when we engage in our conversation. He was also the 2012 Martin Wise Goodman Fellow at the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard, and has served as a juror for the Pulitzer Prizes in Journalism. And finally, last but definitely not least, Jeff Elgee. Jeff describes himself as a born and raised entrepreneur. His early years were spent in an entrepreneurial environment because his real estate parents ran their own business and were constantly innovating. From the age of 15, which is when he started his first business, he has founded, owned, and operated businesses in the IT and digital communication sectors. In 2013, he retired as the founder and CEO of Lucidia Limited, the largest integrated marketing and communications agency in Northern Ontario. He is now the CEO and majority shareholder of Village Media, and has been recognized locally and regionally with a wide range of business and entrepreneurship awards. So the way we're going to run today's session, our topic is going niche or going local, finding new news opportunities. And we have with us today two people who have done precisely that in different ways. So, but before we get into a conversation with either of them, I'm going to hand over the floor to April Lindgren, and April will take 10 minutes presenting for us some of her research on the state of local news in Canada. And I think that would be really helpful to set up a conversation for how innovation can stimulate a climate for the creation of local news.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you, Sonia. So I think my job here today is to talk, sort of describe the lay of the land so that we all have a really clear understanding of why innovation is so necessary and important in terms of creating sustainable journalism models in the local news sector in particular. So the underlying premise of what I do and the research that I'm working on is that there's a reason to be concerned if we don't have journalists covering city council or reporting on the latest police investigations or on how money raised by the United Way is being spent. There's not a lot of Canadian research particularly, but we can look to work done in other places about why local news matters. I'm not going to get into these points in any great detail because we don't have time, but I think it's summed up pretty well by the U.S.-based Knight Commission on the on information needs of communities when they said that they concluded that as vital that information is, as they put it, as vital to the healthy functioning of communities as clean air, safe streets, good schools, and public health. I think it's also useful in terms of having any discussion about local news and its role in communities to know that scholars have identified 8 different types of what they call critical information that they think citizens need to successfully navigate everyday life. And that list includes news and information about emergencies and risks, health, education, transportation, economic opportunities, the environment, and civic and political matters. So I mentioned this idea of critical information needs because it underpins my thinking about what I call local news poverty. And I suggest that local news poverty exists when, to varying degrees in places, depending on whether those critical information needs are being met and how whether all of them are being met or some of them are being met. And that allows us to talk in a more nuanced way about this idea of new local news poverty. So I'm going to talk this evening about a couple of the projects that we've undertaken at the Local News Research Project. And one of them is the Local News Map, which tracks changes to local news outlets across the country. And a separate study that we've done that examined how media in 8 different communities covered the local race for Member of Parliament back in the 2015 federal election. So I'm going to talk about each of these in turn, but really the lead on the story is that local news is at risk, it's available unevenly across the country, and really it's in real need of innovation to solve some of its most pressing problems. So to begin, I want to just talk for a minute about the local news map. It's a crowdsourced tool that allows contributors to add information about changes to local news. So the launch of a new news organization locally, the shutdown of a local news organization, service increases, service reductions, anything that affects local broadcast, online, or print news media. What does the map tell us? Well, we just downloaded the data for as of October 1st. So we've assembled data since going back to 2008. We have nearly 500 markers on the map about changes that have happened over the last decade. And sadly, it tells a pretty powerful and disturbing visual story of newsrooms that have shut down in numbers that far exceed the number of new ventures that are being lost. So more than 2/3 of the markers are pretty much bad news, to put it bluntly. 260 represent the closing of local news outlets in 190 different Canadian communities. Another 66 point to service reductions. So that's a paper that starts publishing less frequently or a shorter television newscast, for instance. By comparison, there were only 93 markers on the map indicating the launch of new local news outlets. Now, that includes 42 online news sites that launched since 2008, and I think we have these underrepresented on the map. So please get in touch if you know of any that have launched that we don't have, because I suspect there are quite a number of them. But even if it's 2 or 3 times what we have on the map now, I think it's still clear that digital alternatives at this point, at least in Canada, are not springing up at a fast enough rate to fill the gaps that have been left by traditional news sources. So our second project is related to news poverty. It directly addresses the extent to which the critical information needs, in particular related to civic and political news, is being addressed. So to get at this, we figured out what the local news outlets were in 8 different communities, and we asked how are they covering the local race for Member of Parliament during the 2015 election. And what we found, the headline, were big differences across the country. And I'm just going to touch on these in the next few slides. So first, we found significant variations in the number of local news outlets per 10,000 registered voters in each of the 8 places that we looked at. So voters in Brampton, at the time, there were only 3 local news outlets. They were most poorly served. At the other end of the spectrum, if you lived in Kamloops, you had much more choice in terms of having 9 local news outlets to choose from. Then we dug a little deeper, and we wanted to know, well, how many stories did these were actually produced by these different types of news organizations? So we looked again at the number of stories per 10,000 voters, so we had a good way of comparing, and we found differences, of course, based on where voters lived. Again, Brampton and Oakville, the 2 suburban areas we looked at, had the least access in terms of numbers of stories that were available about the local race for their Member of Parliament. Also, the city of Kawartha Lakes, which is a big, sprawling rural riding east in the Peterborough area, was also having among the most challenged in this area. Now, I should point out that there have been some changes since we did this study. Just recently, earlier this last month, a new online website, The Pointer, launched in Brampton that is going to be producing investigative reporting in Brampton, which is great news. Less encouraging, however, is that the situation has deteriorated in some of the other places. So in Nanaimo, the Nanaimo Daily News newspaper, which published half of all the stories about the race for MP, closed a few months after the election. Similarly, News Kamloops, which is an online site launched in Kamloops, produced about a third of the coverage, and it also closed later in 2016. So I mention this now because when people talk about how difficult it is to know what's lost when a local news site shuts down, at least we have this concrete data that we can point to in this case. So the final measure we looked at was, did people have access, truly have access to a true variety of news sources to choose from? And to do this, we borrowed an index from Economics to measure media concentration. So basically, the closer the number is to zero on this chart, the more one single news outlet dominated the coverage. So in Brampton, it had the least diversity of news sources. So this is all calculating using the Herfindahl-Hirschman index. And rather than get into details, I thought I'll just show you an example so you'll get it. And this slide tells the story more clearly. So in Brampton, there were three news outlets. But the Brampton Guardian basically did all the heavy lifting, producing 43 of the 44 stories. So people living in Brampton ostensibly had access to three local news sources, but really one of them covered the election. By comparison, if you look at a place like Kamloops, nine local news outlets, including a weekly newspaper that provided 43 stories, as you can see, that online news site that offered up 36, that's the one that closed, and a TV station that produced 26 stories. So voters really had more options in terms of perspectives on the election. So to summarize, what we found was that by all three measures, number of stories per 10,000 registered voters, number of news outlets, and the amount of news diversity, the two suburban ridings, Oakville and Brampton, were the most poorly served, followed by that large rural municipality. Smaller cities seemed to do better, although there was quite a bit of variation between them as well. So our conclusion is that where you live is a major factor in how much election news you could access during that key election. So where does this leave us in terms of thinking about solutions? Well, in terms of the research, one of the lines of inquiry we're pursuing in the future is what, if anything, the places that have lost a local news outlet have in common. Can we learn anything about them? Are there any distinguishing features that can help us think about what communities are most likely to be affected by relative levels of news poverty? And from there, if we understand what the issues are, does it help in any way with digging out solutions or coming up with other ideas to try and solve the problem? So we're trying to work on that question at this point. For now, though, I'm going to conclude by making the point that I think we need to be more precise in identifying the problem or problems we want to solve through innovation. And what we tend to focus on mostly is the financial viability problem, and that's a very real problem. But solving the business model doesn't necessarily mean that local news, for instance, is going to be available to the widest possible audience. If there's a high cost of subscribing to it, for instance, or if there's technical issues, people don't have access online, less and less an issue as time progresses. But how do we ensure that the critical information needs reach the broadest possible group of citizens so that they can function effectively in a democratic society? And so it's not just available to those who are technically savvy or those who can afford it. And one final challenge I want to mention that we need to, I think, keep in mind, or it's an opportunity depending on how you think about it, is about the quality of the journalism that's produced. So sure, the innovation you have in mind might be a moneymaker, and maybe you're producing news that's widely reported, but does it go beyond he said, she said journalism to dig into and do more investigative type work? There's a book out done a few years ago by an American at Stanford, James Hamilton, called Democracy's Detectives. And he examined the economics of watchdog investigative journalism and found that the cost of producing an investigative story, as he put it, each dollar spent on stories can generate hundreds of dollars in benefits to society. So the question then becomes, how do we foster innovation that does more than just cover news events and press release type journalism? So I don't think anybody expects a single startup to address all three of these issues. And you certainly, it can be argued that if you can figure out the economic model, you have the capacity and the potential to undertake some of the more investigative reporting. But I just wanted to raise these three related issues so that we don't think that, so that we keep in mind that there's a number of related but equally important issues, I think, to be addressed here. And I'll stop there.
Thank you, April.
Thanks.
I have a quick question for you around some of that data. So when you're looking at media outlets in Brampton, say, are we talking about just English language media, or does it also include media in other languages? Because
we did look at some of the ethnic newspapers, and we have the data for that. But the data this is representing just the English language media. Last time I looked, there was about 19% of the population in Brampton were Punjabi speaking, which is the largest group. But I know from looking at ethnic papers in the past, they haven't produced a huge amount of coverage, but we've got a separate set of data that we can look at in that.
Okay, because that's particularly in a place like Brampton where there's a heavy population.
Yeah, although my research in the past has showed they don't do a huge amount of local reporting.
Right, it might be more diaspora kind of politics, right. So I was thinking, if we can very quickly, because not everyone may be familiar with Village Media or with the logic, so if both of you could quickly just talk a little bit about the models and what you guys have put into place, we can then get into a conversation. So David, do you want,
Well, first, thank you for having me. It's weird for you to talk about the logic as if it's an established thing. As far as I know, we've been around for 3 months, and so my son, it reminds me, I'm kind of comparing the same number of weeks that we've been alive to my son's birth and where we are, so he's not walking yet, the logic, my son is. The logic is not walking yet, we're still crawling. But we are a subscription news site focused on the innovation economy in Canada. And what that really means is we're focused on the future of the country. Everything related to the fourth industrial revolution, technology, how it impacts our lives, whether that be politically, economically. We're sitting in, of course, Google's offices, a large company that's impacting our lives, but also cognitively, how it's impacting our society and how it's impacting our kids and everything else. So that's the way that we view the world. And through that, it's our belief that we can cover every story out there through that lens of technology. From a business model perspective, we are reader-centric. What that means is that we are focused primarily on our users. Everything we do is to try to build up a community of subscribers who not only engage with us to read our articles, but also to engage with each other, and ideally build a community where ultimately we give people permission to have hard conversations, and that's a really important part of what journalism is. We believe in less, not more, so from a journalism perspective, we really focus on playing in the sandbox where nobody else is. We don't want to tell stories that other outlets are already doing and waste our time matching them, which is a term for when you quickly, you know, react to what somebody else is doing. Our job is to drive the agenda by giving you news that you can't get anywhere else.
And how do you create the sense of community?
We have a bunch of ways. So today, for example, we had a conference call among our subscribers where if you are a subscriber, you can dial in and talk to our reporters. So we did an analysis of the new NAFTA, I'll call it, because the other acronym is too hard to say. And so two of our reporters who dove into that story deeply over the last 72 hours had a conference call where subscribers could ask them questions and talk about breakdown what it means to the innovation economy or for the innovation economy. We also have subscriber surveys that go out once a month where we gauge the assessment of how our stories are doing or how people are feeling about certain issues and how they're feeling about certain companies. So we're doing a longitudinal survey around our subscribers. We have a Slack channel that is exclusive to our subscribers where they can communicate with each other and talk to us, readily accessible to you. And we haven't started yet, but we'll have events as well, which are subscriber-driven. So unlike other organizations where you have to pay on top of your subscription a lot of money to go to an event, we include this as part of the package. All of it to really blow away the notion that you're a paywall is what's limiting you from accessing our journalism. Rather, being a part of a community is that decision that you have.
Right, so shifting the way people approach that. And funding-wise, how did you start this?
I don't have boots on, but the term is bootstrapped. Friends and family. We are a small startup, and we are funded by friends and family and our subscribers. And already our subscribers are supporting our mission and our work. And our cost structure is low, which we can talk about and get into when we talk about business models and how they work and viability. So that is our main revenue stream.
And you do accept interns, right? Because there's a whole bunch of potential interns here.
We would love interns, so please come and talk to me afterwards. Or Zane, when he arrives, he just filed a story. So please come and talk to us afterwards.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for that.
Jeff?
Great. Thank you. Thanks for having me. So Village Media was founded, the beginnings of it were actually about 15 years ago in Sault Ste. Marie with a small little site, which started as a coupon site, but became quickly a news site and became kind of the go-to place for news in the community. But Village Media started 5 years ago when I took over the Sioux site as well as a sister site in North Bay. We now operate 10 local digital-only news publications in Northern Ontario and Simcoe County. And we also license our platform to 3 markets with Rogers Media, 2 markets with Glacier Media, and 1 with Laurentian Media Group and 1 with Dugo Media. So we're now including a regional business publication in 18 markets in Canada, 10 of which have launched in the last 12 months. We focus on comprehensive local coverage. So we, in every one of our markets, we employ full-time journalists. Usually a community editor leads a team of varying sizes depending on the maturity and the size of the community itself. We have dedicated salespeople in each market. And we, I think as Aaron mentioned earlier, our audience looks to us for local news as much as we subscribe to Canadian press content and license national news and business news and world news. And we carry things like horoscopes and lottery results. 97% of our content viewership across the entire network is something local. So local news first, obituaries, and even in some markets now classifieds and jobs and real estate and automotive listings.
Sorry, so that's the 97%?
Yes.
Right? But the obituaries are not written by reporters?
Correct. The obituaries are provided by funeral homes and families.
Right. So how much content would you say is created in-house that is...
The bulk of the content, so if you look at the network, the bulk of our local content, which is 97% of the page viewership, probably 70% is local news. About, depending on the market, 20% might be obituaries and 15% might be classifieds, but in some markets that's nothing and it's a little bit more weighted towards
obituaries. So when you're saying content, you're including everything, advertising content plus local journalistic content?
Not advertising content.
Okay.
I would not include that.
Okay.
In that.
Okay, so what kind of local coverage are we talking about? Like general local coverage, news?
General local
council?
Coverage, absolutely. So every one of our markets, we cover council. Again, the extent of which depends on the maturity and the size of the market. So if you look at best in class would be Sault Ste. Marie, where in a market of 75,000 people, we have 10 people in editorial. So we have 2 reporters at every council session. We live stream every council session. We are the lead of the municipal mayoral and councillor debates in cooperation with the university, and Shaw Cable actually accepts our streams for the feed, so we manage the questions and moderate the discussion. So that would be really extensive, but every market covers council is a guarantee, and then a broad range of
general
local news. Yes.
So I thought maybe we'd start with just this question, which is, In one of the papers, in the paper that you wrote when you were working with Clay Christensen,
yeah.
You talked about this period, which is the end stage of disruption, right? Are we beyond the end stage of disruption? Have we passed that stage?
So the fun news is that disruption never stops in any industry, in any cycle. Mm-hmm. There are businesses that are marching up the disruption curve, and they do that in the pursuit of profits, as they should, as businesses.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually their fiduciary duty. But as they continue to pursue profits, they move up the disruption curve, by increasing their margins and by essentially having to do more for more people. And by doing that, they open themselves up and create a vulnerability at the bottom of the market for new entrants to come in. And so the short answer is disruption is always happening. You know, yesterday's disruptor, Time Magazine, for example, which started as a, began life as an aggregator in 1929 that just curated a small bunch of headlines, was itself, you could argue, disrupted until Mark Benioff came in and bought it a couple weeks ago. So we're all constantly in that flux.
And what impact does that have on, you know, one of the things you talk about is we need to shift how we approach this problem that we have in the traditional newsroom, which is we need to identify what is the job that needs to get done. So I just wanted to go through all three of us and see what you guys identify as the job that needs to get done. What is the question or the problem we are resolving?
I can start. So for me, the key with the job to be done theory is that it's timeless. So the same job that you would have been thinking about when you were drawing hieroglyphics in a cave, or should be, if it's the right job to define what a job to be done is, the same job that's done today. So what that means in a practical sense is, if I were a caveman, or a cave person, and I was living in a cave 30,000 years ago, I needed to know what was happening over that hill to keep my family safe, to know how to feed my family, and to know whether we needed to flee or go somewhere else. That's news. And that was news then, and it's still news today. And all forms of journalism, if you really want to talk about journalism, not entertainment, which is a large part of what we define as news as well, real journalism is fundamentally about that thing, that job, which is how do I keep my family safe? The other job that we do, I think, is we entertain and distract from your daily lives, just like a drama or an entertainment would do. So for me, the job actually hasn't changed at all, which is why starting the logic was a logical idea in that we just wanted to continue that work. And I think that if you focus on the work, the job of trying to inform people and worry less about what platforms you use to tell those jobs and how you, the mechanisms or the business models, I think you're in good shape. And if it's a timeless job, you're okay. So in practical terms, I think we sometimes get distracted by print media or digital media or broadcast media or radio. I've done all of them. And I can tell you that throughout all of them is the same job, or at least it should be. And so I think sometimes, even this week, I think there's a campaign that Jeff, I'm sure, would be happy to share what his thoughts are on it, you know, about saving newspapers.
Right.
That makes no sense to me. It's about saving journalism.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can focus on that, I think that's your
right.
key to success.
I think we might all agree on that.
Yes.
Yeah. You won't get any argument from me.
No, either.
So what do you think, Jeff?
I think David is exactly right. I would agree. If you look at what we do, most of our journalists have come from newspapers.
Right.
And when they come to work with us, we tell them to do nothing different than what they always did at a newspaper. We don't tell them to write headlines different. We don't tell them to write shorter copy. All of those things are myths. Mm-hmm. They're told to come in and tell stories and do their work as a journalist as best they can. We are a platform, but the reality is that people love good quality content, whether that's journalism or other forms of information, et cetera. It's key.
So you had an example of one of your markets where a newspaper collapsed and you came in and hired the same team, right?
Yes.
Could you talk a bit about that?
Sure. It was the Aurelia example that Aaron spoke to earlier.
Yeah.
We've had other examples. Guelph is one as well. And we've had many markets where newspapers have cut back and we've hired reporters from them. If you look at Aurelia, that was a daily, as Aaron said, that had been around for a long, long time, had a good quality team of journalists that were there that obviously got displaced in the shutdown, and we hired all of them. We hired the publisher, the regional editor, the regional reporter, and then complemented that with the same kind of freelance team. And that site has been one of our best quick success stories for two reasons. One, there was a void in local coverage, which the Globe and Mail described quite well. And two, we had an excellent team of journalists that wrote all the same things that they were doing at the Packet and Times before. So what we've done is we've been able to make sure that those teams focus on that job. And so we've centralized a lot of things like the platform which we've built, our integration to social media, the way that we launch and promote and build up audience, the way we acquire email subscribers. So we've, you know, I wouldn't say by any means we're expert, we're learning every single day, but we continue to learn how to build an efficient platform and distribution tools to get great content out.
Right.
And so that's how we've helped kind of amplify their voices and let them focus on their jobs.
So April, what would your concerns be as you're listening to these two different models and you're thinking, well, there's this expectation or this hope that public service journalism reaches the average citizen. What do you think might be certain challenges listening to this?
You want me to start a fight?
Preferably, yes. We'll get some.
No, I mean, I think there's all sorts of information and news that people need in communities. I mean, you need to know the basics of what's happening at City Council. You also need to know, ideally, a more investigative approach that's digging deeper into issues. And the question is, are communities being given those sorts of different levels of news and journalism? And I don't think we should idealize the past. I mean, there's plenty of places that have had not very good journalism being provided to them over many years. Mm-hmm. And I think there's also been kind of a death by a thousand cuts issue happening as well, whereas we get to the point where there's so little news being provided that, you know, people are thinking, well, why does this news organization even matter? I don't care if the paper closes or if the TV station continues to function, because there's nothing in it anyway. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, either it was never very good, or there have been such a series of cuts and a reduction in the kinds of work that they're doing that it's people don't value it anymore. Mm. I mean, I always joke that I think journalism's the only business I know where people have a product and they think that the way to sell more of it is to cut it, slash and burn, and then make people expect them to pay the same price or more for it, for getting less.
Right.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting hearing you talk about even the logic and Aaron's in his description as an investigative news site. I'll be honest, that was never our goal. We don't set out every day saying we're going to be an investigative news outlet and, you know, we're going to go with the tip of the spear. And because my as an editor, my concern in doing that is everything becomes a square peg in a round hole, right? If you're looking for the investigations, then you're actually not doing your job. Our job is to cover the innovation economy. Mm-hmm. And in covering the innovation economy, investigations may bubble out of that. Mm-hmm. But fundamentally, we're saying this is the lens through which we're looking at the world. And if there are stories that come out of that, we'll tell them. And I think it again comes back to the idea of what is the job versus what are the tools. Investigative journalism is a tool, but the job is we are looking at the world through a lens that is a little bit different to everybody else. And in doing so, we hope to be able to tell you the stories that are a little different. And so playing off of that, I think I actually view local journalism, and I think your research is fantastic. It really is. It's thorough, and it's unbelievably done. And you know, things like the Shattered Mirror as well are really playing a vital role in highlighting the deficiencies that we have today. But I don't view local news as a lens. I view it as a tool. And so, really, I think what we need to be thinking about and what we're trying to think about is how do we view urban issues, rural issues, city hall issues, not as local news and whatever we define that from as an assignment editor, but more of what are the issues that matter to my community? Innisfil, dealing with Uber, for example, how does Innisfil figure out transportation without public transit, affordable housing, these kind of things. And I think that if we look at local journalism through the lens of issues more than we do through the lens of we need a city hall reporter, we need a entertainment reporter, whatever the beats are, I actually think our journalism will be a lot better. And you may, through that, get the investigative journalism that you wanted to input in the
first. So, I mean, affordable housing is an interesting example, right? But affordable housing, if you're going to develop a subscription-based publication on affordable housing, Who's your audience?
Well, I would first say there were a lot of people who can afford subscription sites who care deeply about affordable housing. And so I regret the premise that you have to, you know, serve the people who can't afford it in affordable housing. There are others, policymakers, academics, people, sponsor, corporate people who care about these things and are trying to solve the problem. So that's one. But the other thing is, I do think we need to take a bit of a longer view on this. I've said this before, so forgive me if you've heard it, but the internet is, I'll look at Aaron for this thing, it's 27 years old. I don't know why you would know that as the person with Google. So 30 years old.
Right.
Motion pictures started in 1897. 30 years after that, it was 1927. The Charlie Chaplin era of film was just ending at that point. We have a long way to go. And I look at things like Tesla, for example, where Elon Musk's job that he was trying to do was to revolutionize not cars, but revolutionize consumption, energy consumption.
Mm-hmm.
That was his job that he was trying to fulfill. And so he said, okay, well, for better or worse, whether the factories are doing what they're supposed to be doing, putting that aside, the ambition was clear. We want to transform the way people get from A to B and use renewable energies to do it, or try our best to get there. And in being that first to market with a very expensive product that I couldn't afford, I don't think anybody in this room could probably afford, they were then able to bear it out and then get to a cheaper one. So now they have the Model S or Model 3, whatever it is, and then they'll get another one. And by the way, while they're doing this and moving down market, you have Ford, Chrysler, GM, Daimler, all copying Tesla now and all moving into the electric vehicle game. So if you're in Norway, for example, you're almost at 100% renewable vehicles. I only say that to emphasize we are in early days here.
Mm-hmm.
And while today we can say, sure, well, David, not everybody can afford the logic, you're absolutely right. But down the road, by doing what we're doing, they may be able to. And the other piece of that is we all work in this ecosystem together. And the logic may be an expensive product, but there are people at the Globe and Mail and people at the Toronto Star who are reading us closely. And I want them to match our stories. I'd appreciate if they cite us a little bit. But I want the CBC, Globe and Mail, and Toronto Star to match us so that our work gets amplified and ultimately is accessible to other people.
If I could just jump in, Sonia, too, though, I think the other part of it is that there are some really exciting experiments going on that are addressing these issues and lots of creativity in it. I was just looking at a site out of Detroit called The Outlier, and what they do is they're addressing issues of, say, somebody wants to know if they're a tenant, is the landlord putting my house up on the market, or are there lots of, as they call them, blight reports on it, which is they've been ordered to fix something in the house. So it starts out, you text the address into the Outlier, and they've got a chatbot that tells you, okay, it's going up for auction in 6 months, or there's six of these, what do they call them, blight tickets against it. And then invites the user, their person who wants to find out about the property, to engage with a reporter and find out more information. This happens by text, and then that leads to stories that come out of it. So like, that's a pretty interesting model to deal with the issue of housing quality. And to blow our own horn a little bit, but there's a National Student Investigative Reporting Network that's been launched. It's a collaborative effort between student journalists and news organizations that have produced fantastic work. They did this award-winning series called The Price of Oil about the impact of the developments in the oil industry on the environment and people's lives in Western Canada. So I just think it's really an exciting, it's a scary time and a difficult time for traditional media, so-called traditional media, but there's lots and lots of stuff we haven't thought about yet, but that's out there as opportunities.
Yeah. David, I'm curious whether you read Village Media at all. Do you read any of the Village Media publications? Have you?
You
talk about local.
But I live. If it was in my local community, I sure would. My family. I have family in St. Catharines, and if Jeff was in St. Catharines, I would read it. The St. Catharines Standard is the publication that I would read in that area.
Okay, so I wanted to bring you to your business model, and as you talked, you talked a little bit about how you revived classifieds.
Yes.
Can you speak to that? Because classifieds was seen as something that just collapsed in the print medium.
Right. So, in our largest site, and as some of the sites mature, we're starting to roll out this model. What we find is if we bring enough audience, local audience, in through news first, obituary second, then you get a critical mass of people that can then reactivate a classified model. That classified model could be basic items for sale, it could be real estate, automotive, job listings, all kind of bundled into that grouping. And that, for us, drives local audience. It's another method of monetization for us. So we have a business component of that where an auto dealer or a real estate brokerage can buy listings, and we have a self-serve personal component where users can go in and place their own classified ad with a credit card. That has become one of many revenue streams which drive the business for us.
And David talked about building community. You've talked a little bit about how that's happening in some of your places. Could you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at, and I hate to keep picking on the Sioux or Orillia, these are two good examples, but North Bay or Guelph, there's a massive people in these markets. The Sioux population is 75,000 people. That site gets about 90,000 visits a day from 42,000 unique people, about 35,000 of which are in market. So we reach about half the entire community of all age ranges every single day. So it's a bit of an anomaly. But the power of that, when you have that kind of reach, and we're seeing this in Orillia as well, is not only are you getting stories out, but you're starting to get comment engagement, which can be good and bad. You're getting publication of classifieds, but you're getting things like great stories coming out. We're reporting on new business openings, reporting on deep personal stories inside the community that are getting amplified. You really see community coming out through it. These sites are now becoming invested in the market, so we're involved in charities and nonprofits and events extensively, whether it's covering them or promoting them.
Right.
You really see a community forming inside the site. And I think that's what enables it. If you look at the loss of classifieds to Kijiji or Craigslist in the US, if you look at the loss of auto listings to the auto traders of the world, I think there's this real, what we see is that once you get this reach inside of a market, there's a real sense of local ownership over what you're bringing inside that site.
And that's translated into donations or?
So that's a new model in Orillia. We have a voluntary pay model, not to be confused with
subscription.
So it's not a paywall, it's not a membership model. You don't get access or privilege or anything but to say that you support what we're doing. And the ask there is if you like it, you can give us $5 a month or less or more. And in that market, I think about 500 people voluntarily monthly provide. It totals about $4,000 a month now, which is a recurring monthly give. It's not a charitable contribution. It's just we support what you're doing.
Right.
So that is another, again, component of the revenue mix that makes the model work.
Right. Now, I'm cognizant that we don't have a lot of time to discuss this, but I just want to bring this up. So we have this $50 million local fund. General reactions to the fund and how it can or should be used?
Don't start with me, at least.
We've spoken. Sorry, this is getting a bit of feedback from Mike here. If I can help. We've spoken quite a bit about this. We think that none of us would disagree that journalism is important to local communities, to the country. I think the government agrees. We believe that we're in transition. We have a business model that's scaling, that's successful in a number of markets now. That's great, but we're still a blip in the media landscape of the country. And so it's going to take time for models like us, companies like us, to grow and thrive. And so we do believe that in this transition period, if government can support the industry, then support journalism. Our issue is do not support a platform. In particular, don't support newspapers, support journalism, and be platform agnostic.
Of course, the newspapers are the ones who've gone forward and made the case for the money.
Yes.
I was having an argument with someone the other day who was making the case for the money to be used, and that money plus, to be used for tax credits that are some form of wage subsidy. And I said, well, okay, but if I'm thinking about, I don't know, a post-media, and they say they got 25% of the money in form of a tax credit back that they spend on hiring a journalist, are they really going to go out and spend the other 75% to hire more journalists, or is it basically like propping them up? And so my person I was arguing with said, yeah, but I mean, it keeps them alive. And I'm not sure that that's really right. Where we want to go. Is it just like creating survival? I'm not sure that that's the direction.
Yeah, it's not making them think.
Right. I mean, I've argued it's not very much money. Let's use it strategically so that it can be used to produce journalists with more training, for instance, and to make information available to all sorts of local news sites on a more collaborative way. So I've pointed to models like the BBC Local News Initiatives, where they will do a data journalism project and produce some national stories out of that, but then make the data available to all sorts of local news organizations, along with basically a how-to manual. Here's how you take this data and tell the story in your community. So an example they looked at was the bus system in the UK. So they did some national stories showing that there was routes were being really scaled back. And then they did this how-to manual. You know, why is this news? Well, the government's looking at more cuts that would reduce even more access to bus transportation. Some Q&As with experts, so the local news organization can just draw from those to back up their story. And then here's how you take the data to figure out what's actually happened to the bus routes in your community. So the thing about an investment like that is there's a lot of bang for your buck, and you're helping local news organizations tell those stories.
Right.
The reason why I wanted to hedge and not answer right away is because I spent the weekend, last weekend I was with some folks from Heritage, and the emphasis that I made to them was before you figure out the solution, you have to diagnose the problem correctly, and I still don't think that we've done that. We don't have a revenue problem in journalism. There are people who put up their hand, thank you to all of you who subscribe to The Logic. We're 3 months old, that's remarkable to me. We don't have a revenue problem. Jeff is getting revenue through advertising and through members, well, through support. We don't have a revenue problem. We have a cost structure problem. That's a cost structure problem that is a natural part of life as a company or as an industry. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've been at this for 150 years. And for the first 135 of those years, we were the only game in town. And not only that, we were essentially a manufacturing business. When I worked at the Boston Globe, I sat above the printing press. My office would shake every time the printing press would run. And I would go downstairs. It was the largest factory in the city of Boston, was the Boston Globe printing press.
Right.
Factory. It employed manufacturers. It employed delivery drivers, distribution costs. Then you had actual newsprint costs, which we all saw with the Trump tariffs and threats of paper mills, what that impact that would have. So you actually were dealing with a commodity of newsprint and how that affected your costs for the year. Then you throw in the advertising and the sales team and all the infrastructure that goes around with that. And now you're left at the end of the day with your newsroom.
Right.
This very small part. In fact, if you do the analysis, some of us are nerdy enough to do it, it's likely about 30% of the overall budget of most traditional newsrooms is the newsroom. Hmm. For us, it's 75-80%. And so again, we don't have a revenue problem, we have a cost structure problem, and unfortunately, that's the reality of the world that we're living in. Technological disruption makes that happen. And so before we go ahead and start trying to put a Band-Aid on the cost structure problem, I think we need to first accept that it's there and then come up with solutions. My solutions would be impact investments. I've written about it. I think that that's a smart way to boost, to start to spur innovation. And impact investments are different to grants because we're not saying, here's a lifeline, go use it, come back next year for more. We're saying, you got one shot. Prove to me that you can become an operationally profitable business or a viable business, and we'll see where we are a year from now. Mm. That's all we need as new businesses or new entrants trying to make it is, just give us the opportunity to prove ourselves. And if we can, we'll stick around. If not, I don't believe we deserve to exist.
So the $50 million goes straight into helping?
Into the same funds, the same way CPPIB has its own independent arm, the same way BDC has its own arm, EDC, you know, Mars IAF, they do impact investments in the innovation space. They also have SHRED, which I think is closer to what the periodical fund would do, which is create zombie companies. We don't want that. We want just the opportunities for things like what Jeff is doing, things like what I'm doing, to have a chance.
So before we hand over the mic to the audience, I just want to ask April, funding structures, charitable foundations, have we looked anywhere else outside of Canada to see if there's models we can learn from?
Well, I mean, the federal government is looking at making changes to the charitable laws to allow foundations to, well, who knows how it'll turn out, but, you know, one option it would be to make it easier for foundations to support journalism. And the other way is, of course, to allow news organizations themselves to be either nonprofit or not-for-profit. I did, you know, take a look at some of the work that's been done in the United States, trying to figure out how has it worked down there and are there any lessons for us here in Canada. One of the conclusions of some of the research I looked at is to keep in mind that they don't fund innovation. Like, people innovate, they come up with the ideas, and then the foundations come in and support them afterwards. So I think that's one of the things that we should keep in mind. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that often what they found is the spread of the support tends to be sort of a bunch of high profile news organizations that tend to attract a lot of foundation money, and everybody else doesn't get much. It tends to be concentrated geographically, the East Coast, the West Coast. Everybody else in the middle doesn't get very much. And, you know, in the U.S., it's $150 million a year that is apparently going to news organizations from foundations. But that's 0.25% of all foundation grants in the U.S. So, you know, it says that even though it's a substantial chunk of change from where we come from, that foundations have not rushed into the space. There's a few of them that are doing it, but they're not doing it in any big way. The other thing is that was interesting, I thought, was that when they looked at who got foundation support, obviously there were ideological split. I mean, about the top 25, I think, had some numbers. Nine of the top 25 grant recipients, 9 were sort of liberal left-leaning, and 5 were conservative right-leaning. This is some work done at Harvard on that. So I think these are sort of things, especially that left-right thing, I think is one of the things that's hanging up the federal authorities, because they somehow think that having a perspective in a news organization is going to cause them grief, which it might, but I think they're very nervous about that. Right. That's one of the things they're struggling with.
Great. Okay, so thank you so much, guys. We've had like a little bit of a patchwork conversation, a little bit of this and that, and I want to turn it over to the audience. Are there any questions? There's a mic right up here, so if you'd like to come, please line up by the mic. If you could introduce yourself, and then
just I have to try to reach the mic. My name's Suzanne Courtney. I'm a fellow at Global Journalism at the Monk School. I'm interested in your models for engaging on social media, because clearly a great part of your business is generating eyeballs. So how are you using social media, Reddit, Snapchat, Facebook, and in a subscription model as well as a community model, because I also assume that there's some demographics that are defining who your audience are too.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I'll have a very different answer than you will, I'm sure. When you look at our markets, Facebook, from a social standpoint, it would be the number one refer of traffic to us. However, I like to say that we abuse Facebook now instead of use Facebook. And so what we look to do is transition a Facebook audience into our own audience. And so we use that channel, for example, to build email acquisition campaigns, to build more loyal viewership inside of our sites. And some of our new sites, which used to be dominantly driven by social traffic, the social has fallen to fourth position, where email, direct traffic, and organic search traffic are leading the way. So we look at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, not much Snapchat. We tend to always fall back on Facebook at least now, but we use it as an audience acquisition tool. We do not publish any of our content wholly to Facebook. We don't use instant articles. We don't, Aaron, use AMP with Google. We make sure that we use those kinds of networks as distribution engines for us and bring everything back to our own sites?
Actually, very aligned for the most part. I mean, I know AMP is now putting a subscription product together or has launched one, and I'm working on a technical solution to maybe make that work. But fundamentally for us, the platforms are marketing and advertising vehicles. That's it. If we were in the scale game where our model was incentivized by getting a lot of eyeballs, I would consider differently. I think I would, and I have in other organizations used Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, YouTube to tell stories on those platforms. But for us, fundamentally, it's not that we want to keep you on our platform. That's not it. It's we want to know who you are, and we want to be the ones who are responsible for that trust in that relationship. Because I trust us more than I trust Facebook to build a relationship with you, and that's actually very important. It's the data is now, you know that you hear of software. We're a SaaS company. We're a tech company. Well, now you're a data company, and I think part of what we are is a data company. And as a news organization, I think we have a tremendous responsibility to preserve that relationship with you. When you come and give me your email address, I want to make sure that it's used for the right reasons, because that's actually congruent with our own values as an organization as well. So for us, those other channels are wonderful marketing tools, advertising tools, but that's about it.
It also sounds like you're creating a bit of a club, right? Like community / club. It's kind of private in the sense that you engage with it in terms of the content that you can access because you're a member of that community.
Yes, although, you know, we had a story this morning about the Auditor General doing an audit of Waterfront Toronto that we were very intentional in not making that part of the club. We wanted people
right.
to read that and have it exposed. So then it's about your traditional marketing funnel, right? Which is, I need to think of the top of the funnel and how we can attract more people, but then ultimately build a relationship with them so that now you know who we are. And sorry if you've gotten them. You may get an email from me a day later, or you may get a note from me on the weekend saying, hi, here's who we are, that kind of relationship.
Do we have more questions?
Yeah. Hi, my name is Bianca. I'm a student at the Ryerson School of Journalism. And so recently, with a few of my fellow classmates, we went to Hong Kong to cover some stories, and we also attended a journalism conference. And the editor-in-chief / CEO of the South China Morning Post was talking a lot about how to get people to care about journalism, because when you look at other industries, I guess, people, if you look at movies, for example, we never really used to pay for movies. We would always go on LimeWire and try to download movies or pirate them. Or you would go to the flea market and get $5 discs. And same thing with Spotify. Before, you never used to really pay for your music. But with journalism, he talked about really having to kind of follow similar methods and really get people to care about paying for their journalism. And I have a Netflix account, I have a Spotify account, and before I used to be that person who would just pirate media. So I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are on about getting a Canadian audience to pay for their journalism, especially a younger audience. I am a student of journalism, but I have a hard time dishing out a dollar for my news consumption. So. But also, I really admire what you're doing. The logic is really cool. So,
I
mean, when
not paying for it.
Yeah, when I can pay for it, I'd like to.
Well, first off, talk to me afterwards, and we'll figure something out.
Okay.
You know, I think you need, first of all, to dissuade anyone of the notion our readers are young. We have it surprised me how young our readers are. I won't disclose particular figures, but I would say that I'm optimistic based on the demographics that I'm seeing in the early days of the interest that we're generating. So the idea that people won't pay for news is one that I'm not ready to conclude is true, for young people especially. In fact, I think young people have a greater willingness to pay than older people because they're used to paying for things. That's one. Two, if you just put up a paywall, but you don't have an alignment with your product strategy and your editorial strategy, you're not going to succeed. I've been fortunate in my career to be on all sides of that. I've managed large newsrooms, but I've also managed product development, and I've also done executive strategy. And I can tell you that the decisions that are made in the boardroom have a direct impact on the decisions that appear in the newsroom and the journalism and what you read. And so to make this work, and we have by no means figured it out, so I'm not speaking as if we have, but our thesis is you have to have complete alignment between your product team, your business strategy and development team, and your editorial team about how you go about making the case for what you do and how it matters. And most of the time, that isn't a plea. Please support us. In my experience, that doesn't work. It's about making the case for why what you're doing has real value to you, and why if you don't read it and your friend down the hall reads it, that's a problem for you. That's generally, fear of missing out is a huge driver for why people end up finding value in what you do.
April?
I also think that news organizations are, the idea that there's going to be one single source of revenue is falling by the wayside. So, you know, news organizations are doing events, which also builds a relationship with the audience, like David was talking about. So making their journalists available to talk to people, or having a town hall on a key issue in the community. And you can, maybe it's free, but you advertisers want to be associated with that particular event, so you can generate some revenue that way. There's the sort of crowdfunding model, which you've been experimenting with a little bit. And then subscriptions. In a sense, subscriptions plus, because you know, you're not just buying access to news, you're being part of the community, being part of this important information that we all need to make this place work where we live. And then advertising, which some people I think are arguing that there are news organizations that are just giving up on advertising and looking at all these other models.
Just one more thing to add to that, which is, just to be clear, there are more subscribers in Canada to the New York Times than there are to any Canadian publication. And so I do think we have to have a little bit of self-reflection there, mm-hmm. and ask why that is, and not just say it's because of Google and Facebook, but look at how we have run our own newsrooms and the decisions that we've made about the quality of the product that we put out. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, the product you put out determines whether people will pay for it. People in Canada feel like the quality of the product that the New York Times is putting out is worth paying for. We have to ask ourselves as an industry, why is ours not conveying the same attitudes?
There could be numerous reasons for that, which gets into the whole U.S.-Canadian relationship as well. But I also think that you may also find that you'll find the content you want to pay for, just like you found Netflix or you found some other Spotify or whatever. Eventually, whenever that is, I think you find what you say, I'm going to put $10 a month down for this. Is that what yours is? 10? No, it's more.
It's more. It's
30?
Well, it's $300 a year.
Yeah, so 20-something.
$24.99.
Yeah.
$29.99.
Okay. Maybe you need a student rate.
Coming.
Thank
Cash
you.
Flow, beta, MVP.
Any other questions? Andrew.
Hey, I'm Andrew. I'm also a Ryerson student. I recently read an article by the Public Policy Forum, and they proposed a business model similar to the Saskatchewan Rough Riders, where the community is actually invested in the team because they're equity shareholders and they have a real financial involvement in it, and that keeps them invested in the team and keeps them wanting it in the community. I was just wondering what you guys thought about that as a business model for newspapers.
I think it's interesting. I think that at the end of the day, you still need someone to organize and drive that business. So you might have a community funding model, but you need an understanding of how the business of running a news organization works. You know, I think every funding source should be looked at, whether it's subscription-based, whether it's voluntary pay, whether it's charitable status and contributions. But I don't know. I still think you need some driving force to make it really go.
In my experience, true independent journalism can only come from profitability. That's just my own view on it, based on, you know, even with the foundation models, it's essentially, to me, sponsored content for, you know, whether it's left-hand side or the right-hand side, or whether it's, you know, getting investment from a foundation that has a particular topic that they want covered. At some point, it's actually no different to advertising. And so, for me, profitability is vital. You may reach profitability as a community-run thing, and that's great, open to all ideas. One other thing I will add, because it's my pet peeve, and I felt the need to mention it tonight if I had the chance, which is, just going back to my New York Times example, there are other measures that can be taken, and one of the things that the Shattered Mirror report did propose that I agree with is, right now, if you do subscribe to the New York Times, you don't pay tax, you don't pay HST on that. If you subscribe to The Logic, thank you for doing it, you pay HST. And so, sure, I could set up my business in Delaware, and then I wouldn't have had to avoid about it. But these are the little ticks that keep holding us back from really trying innovative things when the policy implications and apparatuses are set up to not make a level playing field.
Mm. And to your point about, yeah, being beholden, I mean, there's a... I was taking a look at the ethics development around the whole idea of charitable giving, and I mean, some news organizations have a pretty clear policy on that, and we worked out how to deal with advertisers over the years and still produce news independently. So the thinking is that if you're smart about it in terms of and really transparent, yes, we get money from this foundation that's interested in climate change stories, and we've been doing a lot of climate change stories lately. I mean, you have to be really transparent about it. And the other issue, of course, is that it's I mean, it's sort of flavor of the month danger when you get into the foundation issue too. So local news or journalism is something
right.
the foundation's really keen to support this month or this year, but 2 years from now, well, sorry, we've moved on.
But that's why I absolutely think the foundations, which we do have, are great foundations, thinking about those McConnell community foundations. They really do want to help. That's where I say that the cleanest way for them to help is through impact investments in the same way that you would any other business that they already help.
Right. Is that okay? Yeah. We have a question in the back, I think.
Yeah, my name is Paul Knox. I'm retired and so free to agitate and say a little bit about a lot of things. But so I want to push a little bit more on the numbers. So $300 a year, how many subscribers do you have, David?
We're 3 months old. I would say that we're growing rapidly, but I was told a very long time ago, when you start your own business, never reveal your numbers or your time frame. You can reveal one or the other. Our goal is to be profitable by 18 months from now.
And
we think we can get there.
And how many subscribers would that be?
He's not going to respond to that question.
Well, and how many, you mentioned that one of the questioners might, you might be able to come to an arrangement. How many arrangements have you got? What percentage of your subscribers is paying the full freight, and how many little arrangements are there?
Our average, actually, because we also accept U.S. dollars, our average ticket price, as I call it, is actually over $300.
Okay. So
So we are not undercutting ourselves.
And what percentage of your subscribers would be U.S.?
Actually, I haven't looked at that number in a few weeks, and it fluctuates, so I generally don't want to say anything because I don't know what the answer is. I'll take a look, get back to you.
Well, because that's kind of new information, and so I'm just wondering about the local, like, we're supposedly talking about local news, and yet you've got these, obviously, potentially your subscribers could come from anywhere. And since you're covering the innovation economy, or at least you're covering things through that lens, although I guess the topics are mostly Canadian, does that sort of, are you still local news? Not that it necessarily matters, but I'm just kind of...
Sure. Well, the Globe and Mail cited us in a story 2 days ago about a story we did about the Quayside and put a price tag on what the 12 acres in the Quayside right. would be valued, and they actually specifically cited us as a local news outlet. So I'll let the Globe and Mail make that classification.
But our topic is going local or going niche, and perhaps...
I don't think they're mutually exclusive.
They're not.
I really don't. I would love to cover Regina, Waterloo, Calgary, Edmonton, Halifax, innovation economy. I think it's important. Love to.
For Jeff, I'm also kind of interested in pinning people down on numbers. I don't know how you measure your audience, but you know, whether some of the traditional digital things like, you know, page views, uniques, all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
Can you
do that?
Can you let us know a little bit about how you measure that and where you are? How many Canadians are, you know, looking at your product?
Sure. There's two sets of tools that we use for general broad-based audience measurement. We use Google Analytics, which almost every publisher in the country uses to some extent now for our own internal data. We're also measured by ComScore. Which is probably the best known national kind of audience metrics company for publishers. Our Google Analytics number across our network would put us at a reach of about 3 million unique users a month, where ComScore looks at it in a different way. They look at unduplicated audience reach across different platforms, and they, I think, put us in the last mix at about 1.1 million. To us, those aggregate numbers are irrelevant. The numbers that are relevant to us are local market data. And you could ask me about any of our 10 owned local markets or our partner markets, and I could share page views and unique user counts on average per day. Best in class, again, would be a Sault Ste. Marie, where in a market of 75,000, you're 90,000 sessions on a Monday to Friday from about 42,000 unique users. You look at a market like North Bay with 45,000 people-ish, or about 21,000 uniques a day. In Orillia, we average 9,000 to 11,000 uniques a day in a market of 30,000 people. That population has 7,200 email subscribers. The page impressions vary by market and are dependent on market maturity and usage of other features like classifieds and obituaries. So a best-in-class site might see upwards of 6.5-7 pages per session, and a new immature site driven more so by social media and interest in one particular piece of content, more dominantly mobile traffic, might see as low as 2.5 to 2.7 pages per session.
And last thing, you have a way of, well, second last thing, you have a way of generating, you have a way of telling how many of those people are actually local, how many of them might be people who used to live in Orillia and now live in Toronto, but are still interested in Orillia?
Yep. Yeah, there's two ways we do that. Through Google Analytics, there's geographic, so it'll take someone's IP address and geocode that and give us a reasonably good view. It's not perfect. We also do polling through our sites, and so we'll look to questions like, do you live in this market? Do you live in the region? Are you an expat, or are you just connected to content? What we find is usually about 80% are in market, about 10%, maybe 5% are in region. So 85% is the local market in the region. 10% or so is expats or people traveling. And it's only usually 2, 3, 4% that have no connection to the market whatsoever. So they've probably stumbled across a piece of content, a story, a classified ad, whatever it may be.
And finally, a lot of those markets do have newspapers, and they do have websites.
Can we move on? Are you okay if we move on?
Okay.
Any more questions? We're going to wrap up now. Maybe we can talk in the after session.
Yes.
One comment I wanted to make was, I really am intrigued by this idea of doing the call-in, like an investor call-in with your audience. I first heard about this from Columbia Journalism Review, which is what they started doing, and I think they were mimicking a process they had seen somewhere else. And Kyle Pope was talking about how great it was because people were suggesting ideas, story ideas, and what if. So it's not just about the process of writing and reporting, but also how can you advance the story. So it really builds on the community. So I'm just curious if you could speak for under a minute on how your investor calls have
So we've had three content. So far, so it's early days, and we're still trying to figure out the technical hiccups that happen every now and then. We haven't, as of yet, gotten any story tips through that process, but I have certainly, through our Slack channels, had people DM me, direct message me ideas, and other reporters as well. And I think it's just, it's more of the feeling that we're, to Jeff's point, part of the community, and that we're accessible. I hope we are. We are not the God voice from on high telling you the news of the day,
right.
And there you go. Thank you, Edward R. Murrow. That's not our job. We are here because we believe in the future of Canada, and we know you do as well. And let's work together to figure out how to do it. Now, I should also point out, because it's the inevitable next question, yes, we have already reported on some of our subscribers, and no, we have not had any influence in our reporting on those subscribers and our coverage of them as of yet. Everybody seems to understand the bargain they're making when they sign up.
Great. Well, that's a great way to end this conversation. I'm going to pass it over to Natalie Turvey for closing remarks.
Thanks so much, Tanya. My name is Natalie Turvey. I'm Executive Director of the Canadian Journalism Foundation. And I'm thrilled that we could kick off our JTalk season exploring some of the bright spots in Canadian digital media. On behalf of the CJF, I'd like to thank April for sharing her important work on what's happening to local news in communities across Canada. And our thanks to David and Jeff for sharing their vital experimentation and innovation and successes in the face of technological disruption. We're all buoyed by the work you're doing. And finally, a sincere thanks to Sonia Fatah for the work, and I mean work, she put into crafting questions and going back and forth with our panelists to make this a conversation we can all benefit from. So please join me in a round of appreciation for our speakers. And our thanks as well to Aaron Brindle and to Google Canada for hosting us tonight. It's always wonderful to be in this space. I know I'm the only thing standing between you and a cocktail reception, but I have a very brief CJF ad of our upcoming JTalk season. We have some amazing speakers on deck, and we hope you'll join us. So on October 17th, a super group of journalism thought leaders are with us, Vivian Schiller, Jeff Jarvis, and Jay Rosen, for a conversation on the state of media, survival strategies in the age of misinformation. And on November 4th, we have the investigative journalist of the year who keeps landing bombshell after bombshell, and he just turned 30. Ronan Farrow is in town for a conversation with Robin Doolittle, and we have a handful of tickets left for this one. On November 8th, and this just came in today, we have another journalistic powerhouse, Suzanne Craig. She's also one of ours. She's Canadian. And she's here to talk about how Trump got rich and the story behind the story of that massive investigation on the front page of the New York Times this week. And on November 29th, we have a Canadian exclusive book launch with former editor of The Guardian, Alan Rusbridger, who'll talk about his new book, Breaking News, and what it means to journalism in North America and globally. You can have a look at our social media and our website for details on these events. We hope to see you there. And finally, my thanks to all of you for joining us and for supporting the work of the CJF. I hope you'll stay and for the cocktail reception and continue the conversation with our panel. Thank you so much.